WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we're going to be talking about a topic that in some ways we shouldn't have to talk about, because this is something that should happen as a matter of course, as a matter of ordinary events. We're talking about the safeguarding of medical personnel and civilians, for that matter, in times of war. That is, in what we sometimes think of as war zones, that the activity of tending to the wounded, tending to the dying, should be something that is done within safe boundaries. That is, those sorts of places, hospitals and the like, should be completely off limits to our conflicts, to military attacks, and so on. And yet, of course, anybody who pays attention knows very well that this, in fact, is not always the way war is conducted, and that sometimes innocent doctors, nurses, orderlies, patients, civilians assisting them find themselves as targets. And this is explored in a really interesting new book, which is called Perilous Medicine: The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War. The author, Leonard Rubinstein, examines the long history of such safeguards, the way in which such safeguards have been put in place through history, and then the way in which, in certain situations, those safeguards have been encroached upon, in some cases perhaps even ignored altogether. And his book also explores some ways in which such safeguards can be strengthened, and in which such tragic incidents can perhaps be reduced or limited or eliminated altogether. Leonard Rubinstein is professor and director of the Program on Human Rights and Health in Conflict at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, previously president of Physicians for Human Rights, and someone who has studied extensively and spoken extensively on the concern of violence against healthcare and healthcare practitioners. His very interesting book is published by Columbia University Press. Again, it is titled Perilous Medicine: The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War. Professor Leonard Rubinstein, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks very much for having me.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. Can you just say a word, please, about that aspect of your biography, that you are director of the Program on Human Rights and Health in Conflict at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health? Tell us more about that program and its essential purpose.
Yes, you know, it's an unusual program. I'm sure that's why you asked. Because although we've known that public health is concerned with all, as a field, is concerned with all aspects of health, from, of course, the pandemic response to safe childbirth to vaccinations to a whole host of other issues and health problems, and it's made enormous progress in the last generation in dealing with HIV/AIDS and reducing death in childbirth Smallpox has been eliminated from the world. And yet, in the most unstable countries, of which there are many, health has been neglected. And they have the worst health indicators in the world. People suffer from the worst health indicators. The effort to eradicate polio as smallpox was eradicated was supposed to be completed by the year 2000. And here we're 20 years later and it hasn't been. And yet the reason is that in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan and other places, vaccinators, mostly community health workers, women, are killed while they're out in their rounds doing childhood vaccinations. Programs have to be suspended. Hundreds of thousands of kids are not vaccinated. Polio develops, and it's still with us. So this program is designed to bring greater attention and do research and writing to both the public health community and the larger public about the extent of this problem. And one dimension that is so critical is the violence inflicted on healthcare and war. And just to give you an example, a small data point, as it were, that over the last 5 years, we've tracked 4,000 discrete incidents of violence in conflict against healthcare. And what that amounts to with respect to health, the health workforce and hospitals and clinics, is that every 2 days, a hospital or clinic is damaged or destroyed. And every 3 days, on average, a health worker is killed. So this is tragic, of course, for them and their families. And what it does to people in need of healthcare is make it unavailable, and sometimes for years later, after the war ends. So that's what the program aims to try to address. It's been a highly neglected area of public health.
That was one of the points you made early in the book that I found almost as shocking as sort of the central concern. That is the neglect of this, the fact that, in fact, it really has not been talked about, written about, explored nearly as much as it warrants. Can you attribute that to anything?
I think it's a combination of a number of factors that over the course of the last 30 years, there has been an effort to establish health programs in low-income and medium-income countries. But those programs tend to be developed where they can have the health infrastructure and the stability to have them succeed. Although it's also true that even in unstable countries, in war-torn countries, progress has been made. So one aspect is it's just simpler to go to other places. Another reason is the absence of reporting about the problem. It was only in the last 5 years that any of the kind of data that I just cited has been collected. So people, even in the field of public health, were not aware of the scope and extent of the problem. So on the one hand, there was the ease of addressing more stable countries. And on the other hand, there was no information getting out except for the handful of reports that NGOs put out occasionally.
Your book opens with an introduction that takes us into the heart of the war in Bosnia in the spring of 1992. This is one of any number of examples of war's encroachment on medical care and health care. You could have chosen any of them. You chose this one with which to begin your book. First, describe to our listeners what we read in the introduction and why you thought this was an effective place to begin your book.
Sure. The reason I began with Bosnia was it was my first exposure And it opened my eyes to the problem as I'm trying to open other people's eyes in the book. And I went to Bosnia, and it was 1996, right? It was after the war had ended. And I had just started working as director of Physicians for Human Rights. And before I got there, the organization had written a report on attacks on healthcare in the war in former Yugoslavia. And we decided to release it in Sarajevo because that's where the international media was. So I traveled there, and it was my first trip to the region, first of many, it turned out. And what I saw and what I learned was really quite overwhelming. And the one story that stayed with me and with which I begin the book concerns an attack on a pediatric hospital during the war. A pediatrician, Dr. Zesevic, was caring for a lot of babies in a neonatal ward. They were in incubators, and with very little warning, they were told that they might be shelled. And sure enough, they were shelled. They managed to get the babies out of the unit to go next door and were in a basement, but that building was also shelled. And the unit where they had been was destroyed. But overnight, because the building where they were, where they fled to, was shelled, it lost electricity, it lost water, and it was very cold. So overnight, 9 of these babies in incubators died. And that kind of wrenching story is repeated so many times with different facts, but that's what got me going. And after that, I got involved in doing investigations in other countries and to try to understand what was going on.
You say, after recounting the specifics of this really brutal scene and wrenching tragedy, you go on to say the assaults, like we are talking about, often create havoc far beyond the deaths and injuries in the moment. And I think you're talking here in particular about the impact that these kind of attacks have on those trying to provide this kind of medical care. Tell us more about that.
Well, it's both them and the population. Here's one example. In the Saudi Arabian war in Yemen that began in 2015 and is still going on, the Saudis indiscriminately bombed urban areas throughout Yemen, and they destroyed the health system. As a result, the number of children who suffering from malnutrition who needed treatment and care rose dramatically, but the facilities and staffing necessary to provide that care was severely diminished as the health system collapsed. The same was on the water infrastructure in Yemen, which led to the largest cholera epidemic in the history of recorded history, more than 2 million cases. And so you see that these attacks are extremely damaging in the moment and kill people and destroy facilities, but the reverberations over time are even more dramatic.
We're speaking with Leonard Rubinstein, and we're talking about his new book, Perilous Medicine, The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War. Professor Rubinstein, I think one of the things that I found particularly fascinating in your book and helpful to me personally was the way in which you sketch for us the history of safeguards like the Geneva Convention, in terms of some sort of code of conduct being put in place that is to guide the way in which conventional war is waged, with an eye for it not becoming unnecessarily brutal and savage. And the chapter in which you outline this history included the names of two men who I did not know anything about at all until reading your book, Francis Lieber and Henri Dunant, who were instrumental in helping to shape some of these policies in the beginning. And one of the things a point you make is that the two of them were very, very different people, that is, different from each other, and I presume never even met or ever worked together, but they were working on this same matter at roughly the same time, but from two very different personal perspectives. Can you just explain the significance of these two men and what made them different from one another?
Yes, and there is a paradox, actually, that thanks to the work of Henri Dunant and his successors, the protection of healthcare in war led to the first international treaty on the conduct of war. That was in 1864, and the protections have only strengthened since. And he believed that every suffering human being was entitled to care, that they should not be excluded from care because of which side they were on. They were not dangerous because they were wounded, and they had a common humanity with the rest of us. And that thinking has been very powerful, and I think it appeals to all of us. And we've seen this all the time. For example, in the Boston Marathon bombing some years ago, one of the brothers, the Tsarnaev brothers, was killed, the other was wounded, and he was brought to a hospital, and a doctor saved his life. And the doctor was asked, why did you treat this terrorist? And he said, it's just what we do. We operate under the same humanistic principles in medicine, and it's for the legal system to deal with what to do with him later. So those values are very powerful, and we can thank Dunant for that treaty going back 150 years. You can even say it was the first human rights treaty in the history of the world, and it always has been reaffirmed since. On the other hand, the other fellow, Francis Lieber, writing at the same time during the American Civil War in the 1860s, developed a code for the Union Army, which also agreed that war and soldiers were not exempt from any moral requirements in their conduct. So he was against gratuitous cruelty. He was against torture of prisoners. He was against wanton destruction just out of hatred. But he said, well, if it's necessary to harm civilians or even hospitals in order to win the war, a just war, more quickly, that was allowed. And he called that his version of military necessity. And that's a very open-ended standard. It basically allows any military purpose to supersede principles of care and protection and humanity. And although he lost, Lieber's ideas lost as international law development, in my research, it started to seem to me that his thinking is still very influential in conduct in military operations.
Right. So we're talking about the balancing between humanitarian concerns and military necessity. I mean, that the one should not, that is, humanitarian concerns should not unequivocally overbalance the other, that sometimes there is a need for a military victory in a so-called just war. And if certain humanitarian concerns must be relaxed or even ignored for the sake of military necessity, then so be it. A point you make later in the book is that one of the problems with that is, in your words, military necessity easily morphs into military convenience. That is, where is the line where a military action is so necessary that it requires a certain amount of innocent collateral damage.
Yes, and if you talk to people on the front lines, unless they're trained and adequately constrained, there's always a military justification for an attack on a hospital. It may be in a strategic location. There may be a perceived military justification for killing a wounded enemy that they could come back into the fight later. There are all kinds of military justifications, including, as happened until the law changed in 1977, that you could engage in strategic bombing of cities. And in North Korea, 1,000 hospitals were destroyed in that bombing, that you didn't distinguish them from military objectives. So you could always justify the destruction based on military grounds. And that's why that open-endedness of it is very frightening.
By the way, I would love to just briefly examine a little more of Francis Lieber's work at the request of President Abraham Lincoln. You tell us in your book that Lieber was commissioned along with four Union Army officers to write a code of conduct for the entire Union Army, and that it was Mr. Lieber who did most of this work. And shortly before the Battle of Gettysburg, Lincoln issued General Order 100, consisting of 157 articles to regulate soldiers' conduct in the war, the first ever codification of the rules of war. What can you tell us about what prompted President Lincoln to want this to be done, especially if nothing like it had ever been done before? How did the notion even occur to Mr. Lincoln? And why would he have thought it to be a worthwhile investment of time and energy in the midst of a hard-fought civil war?
It's a great question. I think there are two answers. The first is, it was the first code, but people had been thinking about conduct in war for generations. What is acceptable? Is torture acceptable? Is wanton killing of civilians acceptable? And philosophers and, you know, military theorists had been discussing this over generations in a few hundred years. But there had never been a code. Why was there a code? Because during the Civil War, there were a lot of really dicey questions that arose. One of them involves an issue that's still with us today. Are partisans who don't wear uniforms and attack your forces considered criminals, or are they considered combatants? This was particularly fraught in Missouri, where there was a huge amount of kind of guerrilla activity against Union forces. And they had to figure out how to treat these people if they were captured. Should they be prisoners of war? Should they be prosecuted? Did it matter that they were not wearing a uniform? And these questions are still with us today. There are also questions about what to do with prisoners of war and how they should be treated. These questions arose during the course of the war, and both Lincoln and his generals were really puzzled about how to address these kinds and many other issues that had nothing to do with healthcare. And Lieber had been writing about these issues for a long time, and so they turned to him to address all the issues that arise. And Lincoln, too, was concerned that this was a war, but there had to be some restraints on how their soldiers acted. And Lieber came up with this code as a result. And it was obviously a very different kind of code than was anticipated by the Geneva Conventions. But in its time, it was considered in advance because it did impose some rules.
As for the so-called Geneva conferences or conventions, the first, I think, beginning in 1863, this is, of course, what most of us think about in terms of safeguarding health, the practice of healthcare in times of war. I found this really intriguing as you talk about that conference in 1863. You say the proposal for the immunity of healthcare from attack generated little pushback as it posed no threat to the military tactics of the major powers. In other words, what it sounds like you're saying there is that in a typical war in that time, there was no particular reason for attacks on healthcare facilities to be part of a military effort, and so it did not amount to much of a sacrifice for a country to agree not to do that. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, I mean there are a couple of dimensions. Number one, it was not a time where, with some exceptions, of course, military strategy did not include forced displacement of millions of civilians or attacks on civilian structures as a way of demoralizing the population. The kind of wars we're talking about were where tens of thousands of soldiers were fighting each other on a battlefield. And of course, although that still happens to some extent today, war itself has really changed. At the same time, there was not much of a concern about the immunity of the health workers and the wounded, because they weren't about to hurt you. And they recognized that the possibility that they might be get healed and get back into the fight was theoretically possible, but it wasn't worth the cost to humane values, even in war. So they didn't feel threatened by it.
One thing that I find interesting, too, is you talk about this early Geneva Convention. You tell us that the primary author, Henri Dunant, and his colleagues, who were very much grounded in Christian principles, never imagined that far-off places like Japan or the Ottoman Empire would ever sign on to this or have the slightest interest in doing so. And in fact, they did. In fact, this seems to have had an immediate impact and reach beyond what the authors of this envisioned.
People still criticize the Geneva Conventions as Eurocentric and Christian-centric, didn't receive input from other parts of the world. And the surprise, particularly about the Ottoman Empire, shows kind of the ignorance of these people about other cultures, because notwithstanding what we hear about the Islamic State, for example, and radical jihadist groups, the Islamic tradition itself contains discussions of war and conduct in war. So in a way, it wasn't a surprise that the Ottoman Empire, which of course was an Islamic state, signed on, it wanted to sign on. And most Islamic countries have signed on to the Geneva Conventions because it's consistent with their values as well.
Over the years, there have been a number of new Geneva Conventions, in a sense, updating and expanding on these original provisions. Just generally, and I'm afraid briefly, what has been the nature of the expansion of such protocols? What sorts of areas have been addressed?
I would say there were three major ones, and it took place after the Vietnam War, which I think was a turning point, because during that war, as we know, napalm was used indiscriminately. Millions of cluster bombs were dropped on civilian populations, and there was obviously a global anti-war movement. And that, as well as national liberation movements in Africa and Asia, led to the idea that we have to reform these conventions. And the most important change was to say that the kind of indiscriminate attacks against large populations were now prohibited. No more general strategic bombing. And that was a major turning point. And that actually had an impact on the conduct of the use of air power by many governments. A second was, because there were so many civil wars by then, and there still are, most wars today are civil wars, internal wars, a special convention specifically applying to civil wars was adopted. And the third was to strengthen the protections of healthcare even further, basically saying that you could not punish a health worker for acts consistent with medical ethics. And just like the doctor in Boston, where he felt an obligation medically and ethically to treat this Tsarnaev brother, all actions consistent with medical obligations would be protected. So those three changes were really important. And they, of course, have now been around for 50 years, but unfortunately, the violence continues.
Right. Another matter that I found really fascinating in terms of exploring the history of this is that very early on, there was considerable resistance, and some of that even from the United States, to certain provisions that others felt were quite necessary. And one of the most basic, and again, we're back to the mid-19th century, one of the most basic questions was, what kind of warfare would these provisions and protocols cover? And apparently there was rather widespread objection to these being applied to anything except wars between states, I mean, between countries, versus internal wars, civil wars. Why was that distinction so important, and why was there such resistance to the notion of these kind of provisions applying to internal conflicts and civil wars?
The opposition was so great that the United States government has never ratified that provision, that change, although many of the principles in that provision have become what's called customary law, which means that you must obey them even if you haven't agreed to the treaty. The concern was this would legitimize armed rebel groups, that they would be treated in some way as legitimate fighters when they were in fact criminals. Now, the convention didn't prevent them from being treated as criminals, just like in the American Civil War I talked about, where these guerrillas could be treated as criminals and imprisoned, or in those days, shot. But that was a very strong source of opposition, that the idea is that we shouldn't legitimize these groups. In fact, didn't legitimize the groups, but that was the basis for claiming these people have no rights and we are not obligated to protect it. And we saw that in the interpretation of the Geneva Conventions, in the whole torture scandal, where the Bush administration claimed that the people they had brought to Guantanamo were unlawful combatants and had no rights. Well, the courts rejected that totally, But that has been the position of a lot of countries.
Fascinating. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Leonard Rubinstein. We're talking about his book, Perilous Medicine, The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War. I'm not sure we have yet made it sufficiently clear to our listeners that your investigation into this has not just been a matter of peering through dusty history books in libraries, but that you have gone far and wide around the globe and seen all kinds of things with your own eyes, including some really horrific scenes of war and its aftermath, all for the sake of understanding this important issue more comprehensively. And much of your book is taken up with where you have gone and what you have seen in places like, for instance, Afghanistan. Can you summarize in some way for our listeners this aspect of your work and this aspect of your book, Perilous Medicine?
Strangely enough, this work, those trips, all very memorable, were the most rewarding, even though they were the most wrenching as well, because I saw how people on the front lines trying to provide healthcare to people were both under attack and suffering what's called moral distress of feeling like they couldn't do their jobs because they were so bereft of supplies and staff and ability to meet the needs, the overwhelming needs of patients, that they felt guilty and depressed. On the other hand, they didn't consider themselves heroic. These Syrian doctors I've interviewed many times, who subject to 600 attacks on hospitals there, felt that they were just trying to do their jobs. And they wanted to get their story out. They wanted someone to listen because they felt abandoned. And I felt very much that I had an obligation, but also, as I said, it was rewarding to listen to them because I admired what they were doing. And it was kind of a privilege to hear their stories and to try to convey them outside their world to the bigger world. So I never, that's my, what kept me going. It's the people I met. And I think that's very common for people who do this kind of work.
I wonder if you would briefly recount to our listeners what you saw in Afghanistan. You describe this in a section of the book titled The Perils of Impartial Hospitals.
Yes, you know, in one of the strategies for health providers in war, a practical strategy, is to treat everybody. And it's a strategy of protection because if you treat anybody, neither side will attack you for denying them care. And that is an effective strategy in many cases. You offer care to their wounded combatants and their wounded civilians, as well as the others, and everybody leaves you alone. But there's still often hostility to the idea that your enemy is getting treatment. And very few people know about this in Afghanistan. We know about the Taliban and we know about ISIS, but we don't know much, or hadn't known much, about the role of Afghanistan's special forces, which were supported by the CIA, which over a long period of time violently went into people's homes and into hospitals seeking out Taliban. And they would go with guns blazing into hospitals seeking a Taliban fighter, and in the process kill staff members, at the facility. And this happened repeatedly. And as a result, the hospitals often had to shut down. Even when they didn't shut down, patients were too afraid to come. So it turned out to be a double-edged sword in Afghanistan, where government military forces themselves were responsible for these harms.
I find it very compelling that your reporting and your analysis takes us to essentially every corner of the globe, from Myanmar to Liberia to El Salvador to the Middle East. And you examine so many facets of this recurrent and persistent problem. And you sometimes touch on matters that I think would not even occur to us to be part of this story. For instance, in a chapter called Obstruction, in which you talk about the barriers that ordinary people face in trying to find medical care in the midst of the chaos of war. You talk at one point about checkpoints, which you term the recurring nightmare. This is something seen at checkpoints within the West Bank and Gaza during some of the grimmest conflicts there, especially in the late 1990s. Describe what would happen at these checkpoints. It's part of this that I think deserves so much more attention.
One of the surprising aspects of this problem is that there's probably, although we don't have definitive answers, probably more people suffer at checkpoints because they can't get through with the rapidity they need to get to emergency care, including mothers giving birth at checkpoints and babies dying at checkpoints, than in a spectacular attack like the bombing of a hospital. And this happens all over the world. And in the book, I focus on a particular issue in a particular place. And in the West Bank and Gaza, this has been a particular and fraught issue where there are two dimensions. One is medical evacuation during active fighting in Gaza and the West Bank, and also routine access to healthcare through the many, many checkpoints that are not only between Israel and Gaza and West Bank, but within the West Bank, hundreds within the West Bank. And what I found, and other scholars have also found, that it's all a matter of training, discipline, and commitment, that you can make checkpoints safe for soldiers and your own population at the same time as allowing people to get healthcare. But it takes effort and it takes work. And that work makes a huge difference in terms of people's lives. And it's very unfortunate that Israel has, over the last two decades, sometimes made major commitments to expedite safe access, inspect the ambulance and get people through. But at many, many other times, it has not, at a huge cost to Palestinians in terms of their lives and their health.
At the end of your book, you talk about, in the chapter called Challenges in Making Norms Matter, talk about the work that must be done to firm up the commitments that have already been made and to encourage all interested parties to be part of this and to respect these norms. And in your chapter called Conclusion Toward Humanity and Dignity, among other things, you call upon the medical community to be more a part of the mobilization of pressure to make this situation better. You call it a largely untapped resource. What is it that you want the medical community itself to do?
I think first it's important to understand that this is not a hopeless problem. This is not insoluble. I just explained how there were periods when Israel really did make checkpoints and medical evacuations possible and safe for everybody. But there hasn't been the kind of outspokenness, solidarity, and mobilization to address this problem. And I compare it in some ways to journalists. Last week, a number of journalists were given the Nobel Peace Prize for their work, and the journalist community is always taking out full-page ads in newspapers, highlighting how journalists are under attack and trying to get them out. Unfortunately, there's not much equivalent kind of action by the health community, the public health community, nurses. They show up at the World Health Organization when there are discussions of this problem, but by and large, it's a very tepid response. But I think if there were more solidarity and more willingness to speak out, we could make progress. There are good examples of leadership, both in this country and elsewhere, where we've made progress, for example, in stopping US arms sales to Saudi Arabia, which were used to indiscriminately bomb. It was popular mobilization that led to that result. And there's leadership in countries by a few health ministers to speak out and get engaged. But what we really need is greater engagement, both by the public as a matter of our own values, and by the medical, nursing, and other health communities, because that could make a huge difference.
Perilous Medicine, The Struggle to Protect Healthcare from the Violence of War, is published by Columbia University Press. Professor Leonard Rubinstein, its author. Thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about this very important book.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tomorrow on the podcast version of The Morning Show, I'm rebroadcasting a memorable interview from back in 2005 in honor of National Coming Out Day, which was this past Monday, the 11th of October. Robert Trachtenberg's book is called When I Knew. Next week, we have a really strong series of interviews scheduled, including Monday, when, among other things, we will be talking about the foreign film series at the University of Wisconsin Parkside with Joseph Benson, who is Associate Professor of Literature and Languages there, and helping to oversee the film series. Tuesday, Marta McDowell, author of Unearthing the Secret Garden, The Plants and Places That Inspired Frances Hodgson Burnett. It was Ms. Burnett who wrote, of course, that beautiful book, The Secret Garden. On Wednesday, the Racine Symphony's music director, Pascal Arino, will be talking about their upcoming fall Masterworks concert, which is called A Night in Venice, that concert coming up on October 30th. Next Thursday, you'll hear a recording of an event which happened last night at the University of Wisconsin Parkside, when I had the great pleasure of speaking with Dr. Sandra Motz, professor of history there. It was a live event before a live audience in which we discussed her brand new book called Navigating Neutrality, Early American Governance in the Turbulent Atlantic. And a week from today, I'll be speaking with Kelly Kennedy, who is the principal consultant for a new PBS series that is about to begin airing on October 25th called American Veteran. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock.
The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org, and you can also subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast. It's available via Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Be sure that you subscribe to The Morning Show with Greg Berg. We're approaching 9 o'clock.